KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Keep our eyes on those areas, seeing if there's things that we need to adjust and tweak. We've also got our incident response teams driving the alternate route just to make sure that they can keep traffic moving and respond to anything that may be blocking traffic on those routes.
Trace advises patience and allowing some extra time for your travel if you're driving through the area. In the meantime, crews have been removing the cars and debris that fell into the Skagit River near Mount Vernon after the span collapsed last Thursday night. Washington Governor Jay Inslee has said the state plans to install a temporary replacement bridge section by mid-June. A permanent bridge section could be in place by September. About 20,000 Washington residents use alcohol-sensing devices in their motor vehicles. The Seattle Times reports that puts Washington among the top five states for use of these DUI prevention devices. Most of those customers come from Washington laws requiring ignition interlock devices for all DUI offenders who want to drive. And new legislation aimed at boosting enforcement of interlock orders would give the industry an estimated 4,500 more customers per year. Five Washington companies will benefit from that law, which they helped write. Critics say the industry lobbying for favorable laws has helped create a system with loose state oversight. And a public memorial for the three Fairchild airmen who died when their refueling plane crashed in the mountains of Kyrgyzstan is scheduled for this afternoon in Spokane. This is KUOW News. I'm Jamala Henderson.
55 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 62 this afternoon with clouds and showers. Support for NPR comes from the Gruber Family Foundation to help extend the depth of international coverage of the world's most significant issues.
Support for KUOW comes from Gordon James Fine Diamonds in Bellevue.
It's 9:06. KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. As the U.S. Senate debates a major immigration overhaul, talks on a parallel bill have started in the House of Representatives. Meanwhile, in the aftermath of the I-5 bridge collapse, what role does the federal government play in our infrastructure repair and overhaul? We're going to talk with Washington's 5th District Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers just after 10 o'clock. Also, tips for humans seeking to survive mass extinction. We're heading into the third week of the special state legislative session, and joining us once again with a look ahead, Everett Herald political writer Jerry Kornfield. Hey, Jerry.
Good morning.
Well, we can't start any conversation without talking about collapsed bridges in Skagit County. Sounds like the governor was working all weekend, and a temporary bridge replacement is supposed to be here and getting things a little bit smoother within a week or so.
Yeah, I mean, his office's early predictions and the Department of Transportation early predictions are mid-June to have what they're calling a temporary fix, two lanes each direction. They'll be a little narrower, and they'll be a little more limited. Some of those large, oversized, overheight trucks won't be allowed on the bridge, but 70,000 vehicles, a good chunk of them are cars, they'll be able to go back and forth. Of course, it's a transportation project on a bridge over the water in Washington, so I wouldn't put June 15th on my calendar and saying it's going to start, but I would, you know, they seem to be working around the clock and to get it done.
I know that Senator Patty Murray said, you know, essentially the check is in the mail. We're sending you $1 million, and I don't think that covers the whole cost of the temporary fix, and certainly not the estimated $15 million. So how are we paying for this?
Well, generally, the state pays and then has to submit bills and get reimbursed by the federal government. So in the end, when all the bills are paid, the theory is the federal government. So that means the taxpayers throughout the nation will pay for what, 100% of the cleanup and 90% of the final long-term fix. But in the short term, the state has money in its regular two-year transportation budget. It hasn't spent every dollar so far, so they can shift some money out of that. And then there were a budget for the next biennium, which starts July 1. He signed that budget, and he did veto a couple of bills in there, a couple of provisions in there, so that'll free up a few dollars. So there's a few million here and there in the transportation budget that can cover it.
Now, what we saw in the aftermath of that bridge collapse were lists of all the structurally suspicious or structurally deficient bridges across the state of Washington, including that bridge that goes from Vancouver, Washington, to Portland, which is of similar vintage construction and, as I understand it, an overhead truss bridge as well. A big question has to do with whether the governor's transportation package will get a boost because of what we saw happen last week.
Yeah, and that'll be interesting to see how that, whether it does or not. We'll start to see in the next, 2 weeks, or the second half of the not-so-special session so far. I don't know that it will. One of the things that has been pointed out is, whereas in the past we had an earthquake that knocked chunks of the Alaskan Way Viaduct down and sort of raised the ante on replacing that, and where high winds and weather and other problems have made clear the 520 bridge needed to be replaced. In this case, this was a driver error. And while it pointed out the fragility of bridges in general around the state and around the nation, if the truck goes down the middle of that bridge the way it was supposed to go, and then no one would be talking about that bridge having collapsed. So I don't know, folks saying that's a man-made problem and it may not generate enough votes for a transportation package. Here's the question, though, that I think the lawmakers who want to move the package forward, what they want to try to do now is change the conversation from, hey, this package is all about gas tax hikes and vehicle fee increases, and change it to the idea that so many bridges and so many roads and so many places in the state are aging, and it's, you know, you have to replace something that's 50 years old, or in the case of the Columbia River Crossing, it was built in 1917. It looks sturdy. It keeps working every day. But, and there's that big but, mm-hmm. they're going to point out, at some point, its lifespan ends, and you need to replace it. And I think that's the argument. If they can make that argument carefully and constructively, they may secure enough votes by the end of the session to move a package forward.
We're talking with Everett Herald political writer Jerry Kornfield, and as you mentioned, we're sort of approached the halfway point of the not-so-special session. What kind of budget writing activity has been happening?
Well, it's hard to see them. I mean, clearly there are conversations going on in Olympia and other parts of the state. Lawmakers, who are actually working on the numbers for the whole budget, are talking to each other from the House and the Senate, and lawmakers who are working on specific aspects of the budget, such as funding for schools, they've been meeting in different parts of the state, trying to come to some agreements, and that they can then piece together like a puzzle into a final agreement. Later this week, the State House of Representatives is expected to be back in Olympia and voting on some bills by Thursday or Friday. And those bills, some of them are going to look very familiar. They passed them during the regular session, and they deal with raising some revenue, and they deal with other aspects of the budget. So you need to vote on a number of bills to get a budget done, and so they're going to be here starting, and that's always a good sign. If they're on the floor voting, it means that maybe they have agreement, or at least maybe they're ready to push the button on action and see what happens.
One package of bills that we have talked about in over the last couple of weeks have been the DUI, driving under the influence bills, or impaired driving bills, and it looks like at least one of those bills is going to get a key committee vote.
Well, so far, they've actually both have moved out of a committee in the House and the Senate. Law and Justice in the Senate, Public Safety in the House have approved versions of the bill. They now have to go to the respective budget committees in each of the House and Senate, and both budget committees are going to have a lot of work to do because this bill costs money. And what they have proposed has short-term costs and long-term costs because it wants to lock people up longer. It wants an intense sobriety treatment program statewide. So these are programs that cost money to our state prison system and probably to our state social health services network. Whether it's affordable now as opposed to cutting it up and doing a little now and a lot later, that'll be the big decision for the budget committee. In the end, there's so much momentum to get something passed. I do believe something will be passed, but I think it's going to be pared down quite a bit from where it's at now, or it's going to be sort of strung out over a 2, 3, 4 year period to pay the bill.
Jerry, there's only officially 2 more weeks left of this session. Are they going to get the work done?
That's anybody's guess. It sure doesn't feel like it when it's Tuesday morning, halfway through the session, and the there's no, you know,
there's nothing.
There's a lot of open spaces for your cars here around the Capitol. So if you come here and you need a place to park, there's lots of them. It doesn't feel like it, but then around here, when they reach an agreement, they can go as they did last year. They did all night last year to wrap it up. So when they need to get moving, they can. But it's very difficult right now, the conversation. It's a very intricate agreement they're trying to put together.
Well, let's turn the limelight from Olympia up to Snohomish County. This is the last week of work for Snohomish County exec Aaron Reardon. Last day of work Friday.
Well, that's scheduled. I think some people put an asterisk next to that date because they're a little unsure. He hasn't done the traditional written letter of resignation, and some lawmakers in the county have been waiting for that letter to sort of seal it and on paper that he's going. So there's a few people out there wondering, will he actually leave as he said he would? But you know, assuming he keeps his word, he'll be gone May 31st, and the next day, the Democratic Precinct Committee officers up that way will vote on 3 names to send to the county council to pick a replacement, and as early as Monday morning, there'll be a decision made potentially for a new county executive in Snohomish County.
Remind us why Aaron Reardon's leaving.
Well, part of it is from a good part of it is because of the Herald. We have written a number of stories, the investigative work of Scott North and Noah Haglin, on just a whole litany of problems that he had an affair, alleged to have had an affair, and while there wasn't large amounts of public money found to have been spent on it, it was on some time, public time. There was also campaign issues that have been under investigation for over a year by the Public Disclosure Commission, whether he used public resources during his 2011 reelection campaign, and just the lack of sort of trust and confidence in him between he and the public, and between he and the county council, and between he and the leaders of other agencies in the county. So he's leaving under a cloud, and after his career.
It's interesting. He was one of the up and coming politicos in the state of Washington, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he will leave having on paper a pretty good resume. He hasn't been defeated at the polls. He has won all his elections. During his tenure as county executive, taxes didn't go up. He'll be leaving at a time where the economy is picking up in Snohomish County at a pace faster than most other counties in the state. So on paper, it looks pretty good. But some of that has just been happening in spite of all of the politics and the difficulties in running the county, or the relationships in the county.
You know, it's interesting. You just mentioned all the great things that are happening in Snohomish County, as you say, despite Aaron Reardon. But I wonder what this kind of loss of confidence in leadership means to the future of what is one of the fastest growing counties in the state.
Well, some of these things are, you know, I think they're going to be short term. I mean, once he is gone, then the focus will come back to who's running the county and who's on the 5-member county council. And they'll all have to, you know, they'll have to take charge and they'll have to lead, and we'll see how well they do. These things tend to come and then they tend to go. And I think Mr. Reardon will have left his mark, and there'll be plenty of stories to tell after, because the investigation hasn't been completed, so there'll be stories to be told down the road. But over the, you know, a couple of years from now, people will—they may not have forgotten. They won't forget him, but they'll have moved on.
Well, Jerry, we'll let you now turn your eyes back to Olympia, and hopefully, when we talk to you next week, there'll be plenty of things that you will have to tell us, because it's all going to be popping. I'm a ever Pollyanna optimist. Thanks for taking time today.
All right, thank you.
Jerry Kornfield covers state politics for the Everett Herald. We've been talking to him every week throughout the legislative session here on Weekday on KUOW.
It's 9:19, a conversation about British actors versus American actors in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from All-Wheel Drive Auto, independent Subaru repair and maintenance on the east side, specializing in head gasket repair. More information about all offerings is online at allwheeldriveauto.com, helping drivers get more from their Subarus.
Mostly cloudy sky over Seattle. It's 55 degrees. We are expecting showers today with an afternoon high of 62. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:20. What is a doctor's role in helping a patient confront death? For instance, should a doctor learn about different cultures and religions in order to help his patients navigate end-of-life issues? We'll get some thoughts from a critical care doctor in 10 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I am Marcy Silman. Everybody, me, I should just say, I love Downton Abbey. And you may love it too. Hollywood's paying a lot of attention to that. British actors are being hired for roles that would have gone to American actors in the past. And Katie Sewell is here, who a Downton Abbey neophyte, but nonetheless still caught up in the swirl.
I'll get there. Yep. I'll get there. It's all a matter of time,
yes,
right, Marcy?
It is.
Well, Kate Hess is an American comedic actress who has always dreamed of appearing on Britain's Masterpiece Theatre. But since she hasn't received that call yet, she's created her own version. It's a costume drama parody called Murder Abbey. I asked her why Masterpiece Theatre inspired her to create a one-woman show.
The writing is so great and the acting is always great. And I love the archetypes. There's a lot of similar archetypical genre characters that are through line through a bunch of these different programs. You know, they're always really fascinating. Like, there's always the ugly sister who's treated horribly by her sisters. And I grew up with sisters, so maybe I relate to that.
What are the big differences as far as what you're seeing in American television?
It's really interesting because I feel like there's like this tide turning, and I've really just noticed it kind of exploding in the last year or two, of British actors working on American TV shows. People don't even know that they're British, like Damian Lewis on Homeland and a bunch of people on Boardwalk Empire, like the guy that plays Al Capone is English. There's like a cachet to them in America. Like, people think they're better trained, and maybe they are better trained. I don't know.
But you think that there's becoming a turning tide where we're favoring hiring the English over American actors?
Definitely, definitely, yes. The Department of Homeland Security reports a 500% increase in visa petitions for actors and directors from the UK. Another article I read said that people see them as white Mexicans.
People in Hollywood?
yeah, like Hollywood directors and producers, because they are cheaper, actually, than American actors. And they've had a lot more experience in the theater and coming up. They have like a career already in the UK, so they're ready to go when they come to the US.
Well, what does that mean for you? You're an actor trying to make it in LA.
Yeah. Well, that's why I wrote the show and love performing the show, because it allows me to like step into that genre. And part of what I talk about in my show is how it's not an equal trade-off. Like, we have so many people coming from England to be in American shows, and I'm an American, and I really want to be in a British show. And there's nothing that drives me more crazy than when I'm watching, like, Poirot or something, and they have the American character, and it's played by either a British actor doing, you know, kind of like an American accent from a David Mamet 1970s era, or they'll have a Canadian. Canadian one is the one that always drives me crazy.
Is there a way for you to market yourself to Britain?
It's harder to get a visa to work over there, so I'm working on it. Maybe they'll make Murder Abbey into a British film, and then and then I could be in it.
You play a lot of characters.
Yes.
This is a solo show. How many characters do you play?
I play 6 Brits and I play 2 Americans. And the Americans are kind of a play on how Americans are portrayed in British television shows. Like, for instance, when Shirley MacLaine came to Downton Abbey, like, they kept making all these comments about how modern she was. And I think at one point, Cora says, like, well, you know, my mother, she has gun, will travel. So they're always talking about how Americans love guns and hate tradition.
Well, what are you experiencing in Hollywood as far as, you know, you have these British actors coming, but you also have this rise of perfection on television that you don't see necessarily with British television.
Yeah. I think that's a reason why British television and British actors are so highly regarded, because you don't have that culture so much of like reality TV stars or models who don't have as much acting chops or experience. Because I think in England, like, they really do focus on training and how long you've been in the theater. And I think that's really hurting us in America. I think we need to take a step back and encourage our actors and actresses to look like normal people so that they can portray normal people on television and have it be believable. I think the audience is totally ready for that. There's so many web series and things on the internet that are just people doing great work. The audience wants to see that. And so I think we need to relax a little bit our standard of beauty and just let people look like actual people.
Well, how do you make that shift, Kate? Not that you can solve all of Hollywood's problems, but...
The internet is huge. You can do whatever you want. There's a freedom there. There's no network executive or some dude who's been in the industry for 30 years telling you what you're supposed to do. The more that those types of shows succeed, I'm hopeful that the networks will realize. And I think like HBO and Showtime, they already do. Like, they have a more wide variety of humans on their shows.
I'm speaking with Kate Hess. She's a writer and performer at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in Los Angeles. She's also the writer and performer behind Murder Abbey, a solo costume drama parody, which is playing at the Annex Theater just two nights, Wednesday, May 29th and Wednesday, June 12th at 8 p.m. And you often work in comedy, right?
Yes.
Murder Abbey is a comedy.
Yes.
And what about being in Hollywood with all these beautiful models who are working in CSI labs or that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Comedians are not necessarily known for their poise and stature. And that's part of the reason why I think they make fun of themselves and what they look like.
Right. I think it's always important when you're an actor to have the courage to make yourself ugly. And I think for comedy, that's even more important, especially as a woman. In order to get people to laugh at you, you have to show some kind of vulnerability. That's why in romantic comedies, a lot of times within the first 15 minutes, like, the woman will like fall, do something really dumb in front of the guy she likes. And those are great, but they're a little bit overplayed. And I think there's so many more interesting layers to women. And the more we can explore that and kind of take different tactics with it, the more that will open up the whole idea of what a funny woman is.
So in Murder Abbey, you're playing multiple roles, eight different people.
Yeah.
How do you jump from one role to another in a half an hour, an hour period of time?
It is tough. I started out doing the show real slow, and you know, you speed it up. I started out playing piano, and you know, one of the things you learn is one part, and then you learn it that perfect, and then you learn the next measuring, and then you put them together. So I worked for a long time on each character separately, and then I put them together slowly, and then just sped it up. Each character has its own kind of voice and accent, so that's really helpful. And then as far as getting into it in like the 5 seconds or whatever that I have between, I try and find like some kind of idiosyncrasy or gesture that can kind of help me drop in the character.
Can you give us an example?
Sure.
Can you do 3 characters in a row?
Oh my gosh. Hello, is this Detective Inspector Bradley? This is Dottie from Murder Abbey. Mr. Stevens, the butler's been stabbed. And then there's another character who is a flapper, an American flapper, which is kind of a take on Boardwalk Empire. And she goes, a lot. So that's kind of like the key to get into her. I'm devastated that my Alfie, Mr. Stevens, has been murdered. But I didn't kill him. They won't railroad me like Al Capone, who's Johnny Torrio's right-hand man running a racket out of Chicago's suburb Cicero, Illinois. This is Margaret, who's kind of like the Michelle Dockery character, Mary, in Downton Abbey. Have you met my sister Ethel? She's so ugly. She has one big eye that wouldn't stop growing out of her head, and she smells odd, like a cross between a woodshed and a rotting piece of meat. and it's rumored she eats babies. They hide her away in the attic.
It's very good. Very good. Kate Hess is a writer and performer at Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in Los Angeles. She's also the writer and performer behind Murder Abbey, a solo costume drama parody looking at British culture. You can see Murder Abbey at the Annex Theater on Wednesday, May 29th and Wednesday, June 12th at 8 p.m. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
And you can find a link to Katie Sewell's interview and to Murder Abbey at our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW.
It's 9:30. How should a doctor navigate various spiritual beliefs when working with patients who are dying? Some thoughts on that in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Science Festival, presenting opening night with physicists Brian Green, Adam Frank, and Sean Carroll, and the West Coast premiere of Icarus at the Edge of Time, with music by Philip Glass, June 6th at the Paramount Theater. Details at seattlesciencefestival.org.
Tomorrow will mark the 100th anniversary of the Paris premiere of Igor Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. As you may know, that performance provoked a riot. But why? We're going to take a look back at what the big deal was with the Rite of Spring 100 years ago in Paris tomorrow during the 9 a.m. hour here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Join KUOW for the 2013 Seattle International Film Festival, now through June 9th. In its 39th year, SIFF is the largest film festival in the United States, showcasing 447 films from 85 countries this year. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
55 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy sky. Forecast says showers likely today with an afternoon high of 62. Overnight, it'll be rainy with a low of 50. Tomorrow, rainy in the morning, showers in the afternoon, a high of 60. And it looks like at least a chance of rain over the course of the next several days. So it's looking pretty rainy this week. Will our hike of the week require a raincoat? We'll find out in 20 minutes.
Good day for listening to the radio. Stay inside. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Doctors who work with dying patients encounter religious and spiritual beliefs of all kinds. How should a doctor engage with those beliefs? Katie Sewell wanted an answer to that question.
I did, and I asked Jim DeMaine. He's a retired pulmonary and critical care doctor who teaches patients and families about end-of-life issues.
I think it's part of the total picture of the person. I mean, there's any physical ailment also has some emotional and spiritual overtones to it. And if they have a religious background, that will play a role in how they view life, the lens they see things through. So I think the more that we understand that complete picture, I mean, if somebody says they're Catholic, that's a whole spectrum within Catholicism, and the same with Judaism or Islam. Christianity. So I would tend to maybe know about it in routine practice and whatnot, but as we get toward end of life, there's sometimes some very specific things that people get into in terms of their beliefs or whether they're grieving. And so I would tend to explore it. I did have one funny situation with a very pleasant British lady. I love to take care of the British patients. I don't know why, but they're all always had a little glint in their eye, and they're always very honest and matter of fact. And this lady had lost her husband, and I knew about that on visit, although that had happened 6 months ago. And so I said, "Well, I'm very sad to hear that you lost your husband, it must be a difficult period to get through." And so we chatted a little bit, and then I said, "Well, do you believe that there's an afterlife?" And she said, "Oh, of course." And I said, "Well, how about marriage in heaven?" And she said, "Oh, yeah, I think so." And I said, "Well, that's wonderful. Perhaps you and your husband can be together for eternity." And she said, "Well, I may play the field a bit first." So you really kind of never quite know where people are coming from. It told me another facet of what I thought was a good, solid marriage. And I think it just gives you a different focus. You have to be sensitive to that. I don't think you need to use it per se, but you need to be sensitive to where they're coming from. And I did have one patient that felt very sorry for me because I hadn't been baptized in her faith, and she felt that, you know, only people that were of her faith could make it, you know, to the next level. So that didn't bother me at all. On the other hand, I think if doctors try to overuse religion, that can be an issue. And I think I mentioned on my blog that there's one physician, I think he's retired now, but before he did a bronchoscopy, he was a pulmonologist like myself. He would ask patients to pray with him. Mm-hmm. And I would never have dreamt of doing something like that. And eventually there are enough complaints that his group let him go. But it's interesting, and a few of the responses to my blog said, well, that would have been nice if the doctor had offered to do that. Or one doctor did this, and I was a little shocked by it, but it was a pleasant experience. So again, I wouldn't think it would be a normal thing for an anesthesiologist before he put you to sleep to ask you to pray that you would wake up on the other side. You know, so I personally never got into that, although at times with a family at the bedside, they were grieving, you know, we'd say a prayer together. Or one family of Islamic faith, you know, I joined a prayer with them. So I think recognizing that the end of life is the great unknown, the great passage, you know, that we don't really know what's there. Is it lights out? Is there something on the other side? I think there is a huge power differential the doctor has. So I think we have to be careful about any kind of imposing our focus on the patients, because they're going to feel disenfranchised and let down if we're doing that.
Mm-hmm. Do they teach you to set particular boundaries when it comes to spirituality as a doctor?
I never got taught that. I don't think they ever talked about religion, you know, when I was in medical school. I think, you know, we all pick it up from our own upbringing and from whatever philosophy, religion, ethics courses we might have taken along the way. I think probably in medical school now, where they're more actively teaching ethics, that there would be some discussion. I honestly don't know, but I would hope that there is, particularly when you're talking about how to communicate with patients and families.
Well, you mentioned on your blog, actually, you mentioned a neurosurgeon named Eben Alexander III, who was an agnostic, but then ended up writing a book called Proof of Heaven after some event. What was that book about?
Well, that was a fascinating book. Basically, he was felt to be brain dead. And he describes these out-of-body experiences very vividly throughout the book, very akin to Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life, where he describes this wonderful, bright, vivid, happy, glowing atmosphere that they can hardly put into words. And he said there was really no measurable activity going on in his brain during this period of time. So there was some kind of, he's convinced that there is a spiritual plane that we dwell in, and that would be our next life. So my own feeling is you can't prove with material things, you know, it's something that might be spiritual or heavenly. But so I think the book is a little overstated, but perhaps that sells more copies. But I think it's fascinating that this one person's experience. And there are others. I've had nurses tell me about near-death experiences and this bright light or this wonderful feeling of warmth and acceptance. and moving on toward heaven. I quoted also Helen Keller, her religious faith. You know, she had she was lacking so many physical senses, except touch and smell, perhaps. I think she had a spiritual acuity, mm-hmm. And she felt that her eyes were opened by the writings of a Swedish scientist philosopher named Emanuel Swedenborg, and so she felt that this added a whole spiritual dimension to her life, and she wrote a book called My Religion.
Do you find that talking about death and the afterlife with these people who have, particularly the ones that believe in an afterlife, or I guess hearing these stories from nurses about the bright light, has that changed your expectations of whether or not there's an afterlife?
Personally, I believe that there is an afterlife. The book that impresses me the most, and this comes out of my own religious heritage. I was raised in a Swedenborgian religion. And the book that is probably most widely read, it's called Heaven and Hell by Swedenborg. It's available on Amazon or online. And Swedenborg claimed that his spiritual eyes were open and he was able to write volumes, really 40 volumes of works kind of about the inner meaning of the Bible. The Bible has a correspondential inner meaning to it. And a lot of the stories that historically don't make sense might spiritually make sense. The book of Genesis would be about our own life and our own rebirth and growth. That's kind of where I'm coming from. But the interesting thing about my religious tradition is that all religions, all spiritual beliefs can lead to an afterlife. In other words, you don't have to be a member of this faith. Mm-hmm. So if you're Muslim, if you're Jewish, if you're Buddhist, whatever, the Ten Commandments are basically, and the Golden Rule is basically in every religious faith. And the religions that are exclusive, I think, are a little sad. But again, that's their belief. There's an old saying, God would let a lot more people into heaven than you and I would. and I think that if the Lord is mercy itself, if you've lived a good life and a reasonable person, you're going to find like-minded people in the afterlife.
Hmm.
So that's my own personal belief. So, but I try not to, let that interfere or trump any of the patient's beliefs.
Speaking with Jim DeMaine, who's a retired pulmonary critical care doctor who writes about end-of-life planning issues at his blog, endoflifeblog.com. Do you think a doctor needs to be well-versed in all the different religious backgrounds or possibilities to be a good doctor?
I think we really need to be culturally sensitive. I spent 3 years of my work life in the Middle East, and I really had my eyes opened by, what they're... Well, let me give you another story. I was in Dhahran, Saudi Arabia, and was working as a pulmonologist and had a young medical student with me, and we were going into the intensive care unit to see a young woman with asthma who had gotten so sick she had to be on a respirator, but she was getting better. And so we walk in, and she's sitting there just scribbling like crazy because she can't talk with this tube in her throat. Mother is there and family is there, typical of that culture. And she's writing. Now, if I was in the States, I would think she'd be writing, get me out of here, this is awful, what's going on, whatnot. So I asked Muhammad, the student that was with me, and what in the world is she writing? She said, well, she's writing poetry, praising Allah. And I said, oh, my gosh. So we tend to see things through our own Western eyes, so we don't really understand the culturally where other people are coming from. Their attitudes toward death, their attitudes toward an afterlife, and we need, I put a big plug in for liberal arts education for doctors. You know, we tend to go through science, 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 and we tend not to develop our own emotional life very well. So we come out very good technicians, but not necessarily as well-rounded as we should. Now, medical schools are paying attention to this in terms of, they call it holistic medical admissions policy, which is really interesting, trying to bring in people with a broader perspective into medicine, telling them to take lots of liberal arts and then do the science. So the complete physician is going to be one that can bridge, you know, science and liberal arts. And it's a tall order. You know, you're asking somebody to be superhuman. I think one of the best things that's happened in medicine is more women are coming into medicine. And it sounds a little biased, but I think women listen better than men do. And I think sometimes they can get in touch with the emotional side of the other person better than the guy. Now, patients have expectations, too. They expect the woman to listen better. So some of our women physicians would say, well, sure, I'll take you into my practice to a woman, but you bring your husband along. So they want a balance so that they aren't kind of the doctor isn't culturally looked at as, you know, you're always going to be the best listener, so I'll just go to you. So it's it's a real balance that physicians need to have. But I think if you can, you know, study some of the cultural traditions, and I learned so much just from talking to the social workers, and my daughter's a social worker. She taught me about domestic violence. Another social worker taught me about alcohol dependence. So if, you know, as you see things, and if you can really become educated, And if you're going to work in an environment where there's a big Latino population or a big minority population, you really need to become culturally attuned. Otherwise, you're just going to be ineffective.
Mm-hmm. Well, and obviously when you're talking about end-of-life issues and you're encountering all these people of different religious backgrounds and cultural upbringings, you're also going to encounter people who don't have any faith whatsoever. That's especially common in this city.
Right.
How does that change the interaction if a person is dying? Does it?
Not much with me, because, you know, some people like that are totally comfortable with it. They say it's been a great ride. They want to stay active right up until the end, and then they want a comfortable death. Sometimes this can mean hospice care. Or even the kind of rare situation where they want to invoke, assisted suicide. But that can be in religious or non-religious patients. I haven't noticed a huge difference between the two. If somebody's lived a life and they have, and some people, I think it's more agnostic than atheist. So they say, I don't know. I'm waiting for the big surprise on the other side.
Guess they'll find out.
Yeah, they'll find out soon.
Are all different backgrounds experiencing the same emotions, fears, expectations as far as their death is concerned?
It depends on the life you've lived and the flashbacks to the things you've done wrong or you'd wish you could redo. We can't go back and do that. Some religious faiths think that suffering at the end is good. Some want absolutely no suffering at all. I think this brings up the whole thing of what kind of legacy you want to leave. And there is a kind of a movement toward creating ethical wills. There's a thing online called StoryCorps, and a book by Barry Baines called Ethical Wills, which encourages people to put down what they want their legacy to be, a certain belief system, a certain way you treat other people, the love you want to express toward family members. My mother kind of unintentionally left one of these. She died unexpectedly after surgery, and we were going through all her papers, and we found this letter. It was said, in case anything happens to me. And when we opened it, it was just like a beautiful love letter to my dad, and it was aspiring or kind of trying to create aspiration for all of us to do good work and love one another, and that she was sure that she would love our children and grandchildren that, you know, that, of course, she would never have a chance to meet. And we still have that. We still treasure it. So I think that's something that people can attach to their advance directive. There are two things that I would suggest people attach to their advance directives. One is a value statement, what's really important and what isn't. Doing an ethical will, reading about it, and trying to leave some kind of legacy. Very important that you have a durable power of attorney for health care. These are available from King County Medical Society or any hospital, a little packet of advance directives. The other thing that people should know about, there is a form called the POLST form. It stands for Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. And almost every patient on hospice has one of these. What it does is it takes your wishes, your values, everything you've stated, and puts them into actual medical orders. And Medic One gets called. They'll look at it, and it will say CPR or no CPR, very specific orders. The neat thing about it, it's signed by you and the physician or the provider. So it's a mutually agreed set of orders for you at the end of your life. This has saved a lot of complications.
Do you have any opinions on what sort of mental work a person should do leading up to their own death?
Number one is coming to face with reality, and that's hard because we're all in denial. And it's not much, you know, when we're young, we never think it's going to happen. When you get to be my age in mid-70s, then it becomes more of a reality, and then you start going to a lot of funerals of peers that are going. So I think there's kind of a natural progression that you become more accepting of the reality. The other mental thing is to resolve to have the important conversations with your loved ones. And really find somebody close to your heart that can speak for you and will be available, because half of us at the time we're critically ill aren't able to speak for ourselves. So this person has to be able to step forward. They have to understand your wishes, and they have to be strong enough to sometimes buck the medical system, saying no or yes, she would or wouldn't want that particular intervention.
Jim DeMaine is a retired pulmonary critical care doctor. He's also emeritus clinical professor of medicine at the University of Washington and a member of a hospital ethics committee. He frequently gives talks to patients about planning for the end of life, and you can read more at his blog, endoflifeblog.com. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Katie.
Well, it's soggy. Soggy is the forecast, but that doesn't mean that you can't get outside. And joining us once again, as he does every Tuesday, Michael Fagan. Hi, Michael.
Good morning, Marcy. How are you?
I'm fine. I don't have a window, but I assume that it's still kind of humid out there.
Well, it is. I'm actually looking out my window, and the sun's starting to try to poke through. So maybe we'll get a little sun in between the raindrops. And that's pretty much what we have weather-wise today through Thursday, rain on and off, and some brief dry periods. And the hike we have is perfect for this type of weather because it's good rain or shine. This hike is Little Ranger Peak, Palisades hike. It's off of Highway 410, just east of Enumclaw.
Oh.
So that's a good location. It's on the way to Crystal Mountain, that area. And a lot of the hikes in the forest canopy, so if it is raining, you'll be mostly dry, and there's a lot of waterfalls on it, so certainly good viewing. There's no snow. All the snow is melted out. I know you ask from time to time, how hard is this hike?
Yes, I always ask that.
Well, it's interesting. The first bit of the hike is, if you look at the blog, you'll see some stairs in there. It's like a Stairmaster, and you gain about in a short distance, about a mile on the trail, you gain about 1,000 feet. So they'll get your heart beating. But then it levels out, and then about 2.5 miles in, you get a nice view of White River. If it's clear, which the odds of it being clear will be better on Friday and perhaps Saturday, you get a view of some of the peaks around. And then you can go another several miles, and you get a view of Mount Rainier, which is nice. Again, they'll be more likely on Friday. And then there's this peak called Little Ranger Peak. It's just a little bit off trail, so if you want to do that, you make sure you have your map and your GPS and map and compass and all that. And it's the map you should have is Green Trails Map 238. And to park, you'll need the Forest Service Pass. And definitely look at the directions we have, because if you blink, you can pass this small parking area.
Uh-oh.
So you want to make sure you have all the directions in the map with you. And the trail is marked, so...
Well, Michael, I have a question. Obviously, you've figured out that I'm not the biggest hiker in the world. But for folks who are well-prepared, you guys already know. But this is a question for people like me. If I was going to do a hike and the weather was kind of iffy like this, besides things like water and a little food, what do I need gear-wise?
Well, we call it the 10 essentials. And I don't know if I could rattle them off right off the top of my head, but your map and compass. You definitely want your rain jacket. Even if it's sunny out, you want to be prepared. You want some extra clothes. The weather can change quite quickly out here. And not only do you want enough food for the day, if something were to happen to you, you want to have enough food to hold you overnight and warm enough clothes to keep you warm overnight in case you sprain an ankle and have a hard time getting out. And you want a little of the, those space blankets. They keep you warm. And some extra water or bring a filter in case you run out of water. You can go in the stream and filter out the water, because you just don't want to drink the water that's not treated.
Wow. So essentially you're telling me even if I'm planning on a little day hike, I should take everything with me just in case it becomes more than a day hike?
Exactly. That's... Now, of course, you don't necessarily want to bring a full backpack worth 30, 40 pounds of weight. You have to balance it out. But you do want to ask yourself, if something drastic happened, would you be able to maintain overnight? So you want to have enough clothes to keep you warm and food. So that's, and the little shelter to keep you warm. Those space blankets are really nice. They're very lightweight. Because I see a lot of people hiking, and I used to give them lectures, but I don't anymore. Because you see them with flip-flops,
right,
shorts, and maybe a water bottle, and that's all they have.
Okay, 10 essentials. Maybe next week we'll go through them all. Michael Fagan is with West Coast Weather LLC. His blog, Fagan's Weather World, gives us some good hikes to match the weather forecast. And we're looking at rain off and on and maybe some sun breaks as well. Temperatures in the 60s. Michael, thanks for taking time to talk to us.
You bet.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
And now, the sound of the day.
Sounds like Little House on the Prairie. It's actually the sound of wind blowing in Pissouri cypress. Listener Sean sent us the sound from his vacation in Pissouri. It was a warm but obviously a very blustery evening in Cyprus.
Just got about 10 degrees cooler in here.
I'm feeling, storm tossed. Well, whether you go to Cyprus or whether you're going on a hike or maybe you're just sitting around your house with your cat, we're interested in the sounds in your world. We'd love you to record 30 seconds of what you're listening to and send that sound to us along with the story behind it. I feel like I need to put on muffler and some mucklucks. Email.
Marcy, you're blowing away.
I am. I'm holding on to the microphone, though. Email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org and be sure that you include sound of the day in the subject line. And thanks, Sean. I hope you had you didn't blow away, obviously, but had a great time in that trip to Cyprus. Coming up in the next hour, a conversation with Kathy McMorris Rogers, the top-ranking Republican woman in Congress. So stay with us.
It's 9:59. John McCain's trip to Syria and his visit with Syrian rebels in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Surveillance videos pose a problem. How to identify crime suspects in a big crowd? New video software from Israel helps spotlight people behaving differently.
We separate automatically the moving object from the static background.
It's a big advantage. You don't have to look at 99.5% of the people.
Crime fighters use software to spot the difference on PRI's The World.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs today from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from the Everett Clinic, with comprehensive heart and vascular centers in both Everett and Smoky Point, offering screening, diagnosis, and technologically advanced treatment options. More at everettclinic.com/heart.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.